All right, welcome to a legendary course in the sport. This hole is a par four. Distance is not the difficulty. The tee shot is not the difficulty. It's the second shot that is difficult. So the tee shot looks like mildly wooded, couple trees to beat, but you're not really too concerned. You don't really have to get too far off the tee. You can throw it straight with a mid-range or a putter. You can go forehand down the left side, probably with an overstable fairway driver. And you can also go backhand hyzer to a landing zone. OB will be all along the right side. And then there's a sneaky OB on the left side that kind of like bubbles into the fairway a bit to avoid people going
in USDGC.
Yeah, that was so quick.
Wow.
And so easy.
I
heard you say legendary course, and I know how Simon's brain functions. He just loves USDGC, everything about it. Anytime he says anything in regards to a course being legendary, prestige, he's talking about the USDGC. So that's where I went.
Well, I'm glad. Quick, easy intro. That's how we like it.
Welcome back to Crushed Pepper. We're back, at least for the moment, on a little bit of a weekly release. We have moved about 5 hours north from last episode, two of those by ferry for at least me and Eagle. Those 2 hours for you were about 25 minutes on a plane. But then another 2 hour drive up here to Nokia and Tampere. Essentially kind of like the Twin Cities. Not actually like the Twin Cities, but they are very similar in...
It's nothing like the Twin Cities.
No, but they're two cities that are close to each other. If you look at the geography, it does remind me of Madison, Wisconsin, because you have an isthmus, which is a geographic term for a thin stretch of land in between two large lakes, which is Tampere, Finland.
Whoa.
And it's a cool part of the country, actually. I can't really say that. I haven't explored a lot of the other parts. This is my most frequented place.
I think that goes for us all.
No, I've done multiple full Finland tours.
Right.
I think I've been in almost every single notable city in this country, at least once.
And? Do you have a pyramid of your favorite?
I mean, Tampere is number one, and all the other ones are tied for number two.
Nice.
I think that's how I could summarize my Finland experience. But it's awesome to be back, and welcome back to Crushed Pepper episode 22.
I don't know about you, but I'm feeling
22. That's great.
What a good song.
When was your first Finnish tour?
That is a great question. I would have to go back into my archives to figure that out and know for sure. But I did a Hat Guy tour here, and I did also a tour with someone that's name is not coming to me. And then I've done smaller tours here.
I know what you're talking about. I did tour with him too.
Yeah, I think you really did.
Juho?
Juho. It is definitely Juho. But his last name, he's also like, he used to be like a really good player. I mean, he probably still is. Juho. There's too many Juhos in Finland. Yeah,
Rasmus Juho. Gosh.
Juho is the Jack of
Juho is awesome.
Finland.
Yeah, seriously.
What did the tours consist of? Clinics?
Yeah, I used to do, what was it called? Flying Circus. So I did some of that. That's where I actually broke my leg back in 2016 when I missed half a year. That was in Finland. I don't remember what city it was in.
In the middle of a clinic?
Kind of.
I was 360s.
Yeah, I was doing like a showcase like with a speed gun into the net and kind of did a 360 and slipped and partially tore my ACL. And there's one moment from that, actually, that I'll never forget because I thought it was so, like, cute and endearing and sweet. I went to the hospital or a doctor in Finland to get my leg checked out. And obviously, it's amazing how good everyone here is at English. Just, I got to say that first. And I would never make fun of someone's language, especially if it's your second language. But the doctor said to me, she doesn't think that I broke my ACL because my leg is not swallowed. And I thought, she meant to say swollen, of course, but she used the word swallowed. And I thought that was, like, for some reason that stuck with me. And I found it, like, so sweet of her to say it like that.
Eagle, you have to tell your story now.
Oh boy.
It ties right in. Yeah, I just heard this for the first time yesterday.
I think this is podcast kosher. Back in 2016, it was my first time ever coming to Finland, and it was actually up in Kuopio. That's where Niklas Anttila is from. And I was doing some clinics. UC organized them with Nate Sexton, Paul Macbeth. And during the forehand portion of our clinic, we were doing like a little random Q&A where the Finnish people would ask us, like, how do you do this? How do you do that? And one of the guys asked me a question. He says, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something along the lines of, how do you get distance with your foreplay? And Finns are notoriously pretty shy and quiet, and it's hard for them to come out of their shell to even ask a question. And it was very, no one was like laughing or like showing much emotion, but at that moment, it was the loudest I've ever heard a group of Finnish people laugh. And from there on out, the guy who asked that question, therefore, was known as the Mr. Foreplay. I think he still is. Like, there's going to be people listening right now that probably heard of that instance.
Did you give him a good times. Answer?
Gosh, 2016. I don't think I was aware of my foreplay at that time.
Wow. What a good start to the episode.
Oh, yeah. Good finish stories. The first time I came to Finland was with Paul Macbeth in 2023. And we came from the PCS Open. And we had... I know everybody jokes about all the flights full of disc golfers. This one might have taken the record. I think there was less than 10 people on the flight who weren't disc golfers. And everybody had just come from a pretty rainy 3-round tournament. And there were tons of We Are Disc Golf umbrellas in stock. And so everybody had purchased one. If they didn't already have an umbrella with them, they had purchased one. And flight to... Oslo from Ålesund was normal. And then when we're in our layover, as we all try to get on the plane to Helsinki, the flight attendant stops. I don't know who the first victim was, but they took every single umbrella that we had and they said they were going to gate check them underneath the plane and then we would all get them when we got to Helsinki. And none of them showed up. I think it was like, I want to say it was like 65 umbrellas.
What?
All disappeared off the face of the earth. So if somebody listening to this works for a Norwegian airline, I'm sure they're nowhere to be found now, but it was quite the conundrum of umbrella.
Wow. Loss.
Yeah, just a complete umbrella heist. And
umbrellas is one of those items that disc golfers have bought more in their life than any other humans.
Yeah.
Eagle, how many umbrellas do you think you've bought in your life?
15 to 30.
Yeah.
15 to 30.
In that range.
I think I do 15 to 30 a year.
I mean, it's just one of those things that it's never a guarantee you're going to get it. through.
And every airline has a different policy.
Yeah.
Some are completely fine. They don't even think twice. And then other times they want to take it away from you and they want to just throw it away.
How often do you guys have your bag pulled aside going through security and they like want to check out something of your, either the discs or your chalk bag or your retriever?
Well, for me, it's probably like 60 to 70% of the time, but it's also because when going through airport security, I'm always bringing so much stuff,
yeah.
Whether it's a bunch of food, really. I have my supplements, which can definitely raise some questions. But in terms of discs, like I'm always flying with Ratana, and she packs a lot more simply than me. And she almost never gets pulled aside. I feel like most people in TSA are more or less used to seeing disc golf discs.
I would say in Europe and North America, I haven't had any issues. Mm-hmm. Anytime I've gone on trips with Paul McBeth Foundation, they don't even know what they're looking at. They're just like, is this a weapon? And then I mean, the amount of times in like Africa or South America that I have like pulled up a YouTube video to like show them, and it doesn't help at all. They're just like, okay, like, but I proved to them that there's not a person standing on the other end of that shot. And I'm just like, it's a game. We're trying to grow it in your country. But I think my retriever, sometimes if you have one of the hook retrievers, that can get you flagged pretty fast.
Oh,
I noticed. I lost mine in Estonia two or three years ago.
I always check my retriever if I'm carrying one.
Yeah. Speaking of checking in suitcases and luggage, you have your bag.
He's got it back, folks.
I got a bag. Huge shout out to my wife. Without her, Natalia, this would have never happened. I have this thing in my personality that I hate making phone calls and I hate complaining about. I mean, I love complaining in general, but like, for example, if I ordered something at a restaurant and they bring me the wrong food, I would never like send it back or complain about it or anything along those lines. So if an airline loses my bag, I will like maybe try once to like call them and say, hey, can I get my bag back? But I won't be like on top of it and like pressing them and like doing everything I can. Just not who I am. My wife, thank God, is exactly that kind of person who will call them until she gets exactly what she wants.
It's that Puerto Rican blood.
Yeah, maybe that helps.
I agree. I think that is a not always correct, but very often assumed stereotype of a Latina woman is that she will stop at no end to get what she wants.
Yeah, so my bag on Saturday last week was still in New York City.
Wow.
Even though Lufthansa, they told me they've made 3 requests for JFK to send the bag to Tallinn. But they said nothing ever happened and they didn't really know why. I just don't know if that's just normal because it's never happened to me before. But my wife took over from there. She called JFK and made sure they find the bag. And they said, okay, we can ship it back to Boston, but you have to pick up the bag there. So she agreed to that. Never really planning to pick up the bag there because she knew she was just going to call Boston once the bag was there to then have it shipped to Helsinki so I can pick it up on Monday when I land in Helsinki anyway. So she said that they didn't agree to do that and that it wasn't possible. But at the end of the phone call, they said, okay, the bag will be in Helsinki tomorrow. And it arrived about an hour after I landed. So I got to hang out at baggage claim for an hour looking not suspicious whatsoever, just waiting for a second bag, which ended up not coming out on the belt where it was meant to come out with the flight from Amsterdam. So I had to go stand in line and talk to baggage claim again. And then they brought out my bag at a different, like a special kind of claim where I was like, when I saw my bag, I was like actually mind blown that it found its way to me. I lost all hope that I would ever see that bag again. Or maybe I would see it when I'm back in America next week or in 2 weeks. But crazy. So now I have all my clothes. I have my shoes back, my backup discs, and my razor.
Life is good.
So I'm excited. Yeah. And now I have two travel bags. So I need to figure out what I'm going to do with that on the way home.
Check another one. No, it's wild. That's kind of similar to, it's crazy that it happened to both of us on this trip. And it's never happened to me before in over 10 years of traveling. So it was kind of like this year, I had a gut feeling that I was going to get a flat tire out on the road because it's never happened to me. And I also had the same gut feeling about my bag getting lost this year. Just sometimes you know. And if it wasn't for the AirTag, at least for me, it would have been probably like Simon's instance. At the very least, like with the AirTag, you can send screen caps to the airline, to the airport that you've flown from. And you can kind of light a fire under their behinds and be like, okay, it's right here. Check here. And that helps a lot. But man, when the courier dropped my bag off in Italy, I was like, oh my gosh, this is such a good feeling. I was so happy. And you got to think in the mind of the bag. It's like, think about what your bag went through. It's like just sitting there all alone with the other bags in the airport and might have fallen off. It's been like spiders have been crawling on it. It's been in like really bad spots.
I mean, your bag took a week-long vacation to New York City that it wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Maybe it got to see some sights.
I think my bag's career is over with this trip. I wanted to retire it before this trip because it has a huge tear in the top and the wheels aren't as smooth as I want them to be. And it served its time. It did well for about a year and a half. But it was time to move on. I wanted to buy a bag before this Europe trip, and I just was too lazy to do it. And then I got this whole thing. So my bag got one last hurrah.
Do you like your new bag better?
My new bag is actually, I think, the exact same bag, just 2 years newer.
Is it hard shell or soft?
Soft.
You're a softy?
I'm a softy. I looked at all the hard shells, and I don't know, for some reason I can't commit yet. Everyone tells me it's better, but I've always been a softy.
There's pros and cons.
Yeah.
The softs are a little bit lighter, which you can carry more in, which is a good thing. I like hard shells because if I'm bringing backup discs, they don't get warped as easily.
Yeah. I feel like pro travelers all have hard shells.
I think part of that depends on what you've got, what you're carrying around.
Yeah.
But I think just for like dings and, you know, kind of irresponsible or just aggressive airport employees who might chuck it around, I think that's like maybe the main reason why the hard shell exists. I mean, my hard case or my hard shell for my clothes like pales in comparison to this new camera case that I bought that's carrying all this podcast equipment and both of my cameras and my computers, and that thing is a tank. I mean, that thing has also gotten to me in a little bit of trouble. I don't know how much, did we talk at all about my Air Baltic fiasco? It's just, I basically bought this case and I knew when I read it on the website, it basically said it was the largest possible carry-on size, which means that on half of
controversial.
It just means that half of your flights, it's going to be bigger than it should be.
Yeah.
So I've done a really good job of essentially when I gate check, I talk to the guy right away or the lady and ask them if it's going to work on their aircraft. And I have like a plan, because the reason why I can't just check it for no reason is because it's got batteries and computers in it, which are lithium ion, and they have a small risk of spontaneously combusting. And so
don't want that.
Well, if it happens, you don't want it to be below the cabin. You want it to at least be in the overhead bin where somebody can come and put that fire out. If it's below the cabin, A, you might not notice, and B, if you do notice, your only solution is to land the plane. That's the only way. And you're risking everybody else's luggage at that point. So I have a small little, like a soft computer case. When, if they say, yeah, this is too big, then I just take the laptops and the batteries out and then check the big bag. But I have run into a couple issues where the gate agent who gives me the green light is not actually right. And then I get to the plane, having already checked my little computer bag with my clothes, and then they say, wow, this isn't going to work. So I have had to schmooze my way into using the... There's a little compartment. I guess it's not little. It's large. It's a large compartment at the front of almost every plane. And it's mainly used for the flight attendants and the captain's luggage, and also used for anyone who is bringing a suit, like a suit coat on, because they have like a... It's just like a place where you can hang clothes.
Whoa.
So if you're ever traveling with like fancy clothes that you don't want to like fold up, and you have it in your little suit thing, you can tell them that, and they have to hang it there. What they don't have to do, however, is take your big gigantic camera case and put it in there. But they did that for me twice. So far I've been fine. We'll see how that continues to evolve. But I've been loving the case that I bought. It holds everything perfect, and it was not a cheap purchase, but I can see why it was worth the money, because the security and the peace of mind that I have with all my gear in there, and the way that it seals shut and I can lock it, it's been very clutch.
Yeah. One question that I actually get a lot is like, what bags do you travel with? Because a lot of people have never really flown before, and they're always thinking, am I going to be able to bring my disc golf bag on a flight with me? And in most instances, yes.
Yes.
If, let's just say you're using a MVP Voyager size bag, you should be good 9 times out of 10. The parts where it gets a little bit tricky is if you're flying on some of those really small aircrafts from maybe a smaller airport, or flying to a smaller airport. Those can be pretty treacherous.
Yeah.
Because there's been many instances where I am shoving my bag under the seat as hard as I can, looking like a donkey. Like, not good. And I usually make it work, but it's usually me having no leg room, or that flight attendant just being like, okay, you know, you're going to be fine. You're good, even though it doesn't fit. But in most instances, just like a normal size backpack, disc golf bag, and a personal item is good to go.
But I would say that this whole, I guess both of your experiences, at least you were in an off week, but for Simon's especially, proves the point that has been made time and time again, that you never, ever, ever check your disc golf bag unless there's a gun to your head. I mean, there should be no reason that you check your primary discs.
I checked my bag.
Yeah, I was actually this close to checking my bag.
I check my bag all the time.
I've heard from some people who are just basically saying, like, I never do it. I never.
I mean, it's definitely the smart thing.
I think it would make a good vlog. Just to play a major with all new discs.
Oh, my gosh.
I literally check my bag for the... Don't get me wrong. I don't want my bag to get lost. But if it does, it's a great learning experience. But it also makes it more fun.
I mean, the whole idea of going to a new sponsor and having brand new discs to try out and learn and get to know, I think a lot of pro disc golfers love that when they have to start from ground zero. But once you get all your seasoned discs and everything that you know, you don't really want to lose it. But you could definitely... You could definitely make it happen if you wanted to.
Okay, I'm going to literally contradict what I just said about carry-on disc golf bag. So the bag that I'm using right now is absolutely ginormous. And there's no way this bag would realistically fit, especially on European airlines, which... European airlines are a little or a lot more rigid in their baggage policies. So that's the reason why I checked my bag. Also, it was so heavy that I didn't want to carry it through the airport, because I had all my tournament discs and all my backups just packed in there. Probably around like 40 discs in this bag, as well as a frying pan, as well as my shoes.
You brought a cast iron pan?
I bought a stainless steel pan.
Wow.
I thought about,
I suppose stainless steel is a little lighter.
It's a little lighter. I thought, I wish I did cast iron, honestly.
I mean, I've been wishing that this whole Europe trip because it's been all nonstick every week.
Yeah. I missed a good hearty cast iron.
Don't you, Simon?
Yeah, big time.
Well, we had quite a week in Estonia. Some pretty warm weather.
It was the best week of weather I'd say we've had on tour.
And this week year continues that. We have yet to see a really rainy day. I mean, I haven't seen a rainy day since Monday of Krokel. So it's been a long, I mean,
this is the weather that that Northern Europeans dream of.
Well, I think, yeah. And as much as we complained in the States all year about how the weather was just, there was always something every week. And then I specifically remember when we were watching European Championships in Des Moines, Simon saying, I think Northern Europeans are just going to be like the future of the best disc golf players because they can just handle all this annoying weather every week. But then last week, talking to all the Finns and the Estonians, they were all saying like, oh man, it's too hot. It's too hot. We're melting. And
yeah, that's the question I keep getting.
I found the kryptonite to the Northern European disc golfer. It's just a little bit of Midwest heat and humidity.
I went to Power Grip today. I picked up a few new discs. And the guy at the register, he's like, are you doing okay? It's really hot. And I'm like, this is hot? It's not. It's like perfect.
Yeah, it's... This is like a million times more pleasant than Des Moines was.
Yeah.
Like it's not close.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Des Moines was, I think Des Moines for me was top five most miserable conditions I've ever played in.
Yeah, that one. And then to me, either 2020 or 2021 Preserve was like one of those absolutely brutal. Like the, yeah. I think it was 2020 Preserve, the first year. It might have been the next year. I can't remember now, but it was.
I remember playing Australian Open where the heat index was like 110. Ugh. It was nuts.
No thanks.
It was like, you need to be in the shade.
Yeah, I didn't play it, but I heard about the Mid-America Open 2 or 3 years ago that Germ played in. And I heard, I guess, you know, part of that might just be Germ as well, but I heard some serious stories about the drippage, uh-huh. The sweat. But we didn't really have that intense last week in Estonia. Simon, tell us about your week. Give us the rundown. What did you do off the course that was great?
Everything. It was a one of one week kind of for us this year. We've been pretty consistent when it comes to our nutrition and discipline when it comes to any kind of going out, enjoying specific beverages and stuff. And last week that all completely fell apart. Dustin's first time, obviously, in any kind of Baltic or Nordic country. He had to go check it out. And I had to show him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was really fun. It was kind of nice to just kind of live that lifestyle again of kind of just checking out some bars and going out at night. And I mean, we all know that time works differently here. It's almost never really dark. It's like dark for like 3 hours at night, maybe. So you just kind of go out to town at like 9 or 10 PM when you usually would go to bed when we're over in the States. And before you know it, it's like 2 AM.
It is.
And the sun's about to come up.
Yeah.
And you're like, I guess we're going to go to bed now, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Surprisingly difficult to go to sleep in these countries before midnight. That's what I've just noticed. Like,
oh, it's so tough.
Every time in the afternoon, even like now, like yesterday. I remember yesterday I said to myself, like, I'm going to go to bed by 10 tonight. And at 12:30, me and Simon were playing Battleship on our phones.
I've been trying to get Ratana on an early schedule because she's going to be playing early for Worlds for the past 2 weeks. And it's not working. It's not working. Every night it's like 12:30 or 1 when we're going to bed.
Yeah. I think my earliest bedtime last week was 1:30.
But you got to stay right by the course, and you
Nice. Same hotels last year. That was a no-brainer for me. Super good restaurant right in the lobby, and good breakfast buffet. So, and literally 30-second walk to hole one. So, so convenient, so nice,
and air conditioning, which is rare.
The AC in the rooms were absolutely clutch. I turned my room all the way down to like 64 degrees at night and slept pretty well for my standards. But no, I had a really great time. Tallinn is easily top 10 cities I've visited in my life. And if you enjoy a good time and checking out some bars and an old kind of vibe city, like, I don't think it gets much better than Tallinn. Like, it is unbelievably nice.
Yep.
Great food too. And even though last year I went out a lot as well, but this year I really got like a whole new appreciation for the Estonian people. Like, they are so funny. Like, their sarcasm and dry humor, like, they are on a different level than other European countries that I've been to. So it was a really good time. We had a nice tour of Old Town. We went underground through like the old tunnels.
What?
Back in the war days.
I didn't know those even existed. That was on the same tour we saw you guys at the traditional restaurant with the big spread.
Yeah, we had the medieval feast, they called it. We were like a group of 20 people, and this was like a tournament organized kind of thing with the tour and the feast included. Just really cool experience. We had really funny, cool tour guides, and we learned something about the history of the city. And we got to try some medieval style food, which, check out the vlog if you want to see some more. It was nice. Yeah, no, everything off the course was first class. On the course was maybe third class.
Third class. Eagle, what was your week like?
Yeah, kind of similar. It's my seventh time to Estonia.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. But like Simon said, top 10 city that I've visited, maybe even top five. Like, Tallinn is really special. The fact that you can get everywhere on scooter is a major selling point and something that I really like about the event. You should not rent a car if you're going to Estonia. It actually is more of a burden than anything. And I think that's a good thing with the majors coming up there. People who want to fly over can definitely do it for a reasonable price, more so than somewhere else, because here in Finland, I mean, you can get around on public transport, but it's a lot easier in Tallinn. But spent a good 8 days there, saw some friends that I've made years and years and years ago at this point. It was a little bit more low-key. We made it down to Old Town a few times, but we were more in a neighborhood setting, just kind of taking it a little bit more easy. Was going to a restaurant that I really liked. I think we went to this place called Cafe NOP or Cafe Nop. We were there for 8 days. I think we went there 10 times. That was like the only place we're eating. And it was clutch because it was really, really good.
He took me there.
I took Joey there.
It was great.
Yeah. And just probably the healthiest place you could find in Tallinn.
I joked when we got there, I felt like, I looked at Eagle, I was like, wow, we just walked into Boulder all of a sudden.
Yes, it's definitely...
very hip.
Yeah, definitely a hipster vibe. Crunchy granola, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, it was great. Felt very relaxed. Since I wasn't in Norway, I got there like 4 days early, and I felt like I was genuinely just relaxing and playing disc golf, and there just happened to be a major event there. It was a nice cozy week in Tallinn for me. Was productive too. We did Ricky's roundtable podcast. We shot Crush Pepper practice round, but it never felt too crazy. I think that's just because everything's so close to each other, and you could zip around on scooters, and it was just high vibes, if you will.
I gotta say, I feel like for a lot of these European cities, especially for the older people, I feel like there's a very distinct part of their memory from the time that the scooters existed to the time before the scooters existed.
Oh, and yeah.
I feel like at least half the people in these cities hate those scooters.
Oh, totally.
But I think that there's so many people who feel like it has turned at least the transportation side of those cities into a bit of anarchy. Mm-hmm. And for good reason. I mean, if they're everywhere, especially at night, you can just, I think we're on the side of benefit. We can go anywhere we want. The rides were like €2 to €3. And even if you wanted to take a Bolt, like a regular car, it's all done on this one app.
You didn't get a pass?
Yeah, I did not.
It's $9 for a pass for 100 minutes.
For the whole month. Wow. Yeah, I mean that's insane. And I think there was the option. It's all done through Bolt, and Bolt is an Estonian company. And it
Estonian Uber, basically.
Yeah, but it's also like Estonian Uber, but it's also Lime and Toro at the same time.
It's everything.
So you can either get a ride from a driver, you can rent a scooter, you can rent a bike, or you can even rent a car.
I wanted to do that, but you...
I did it.
You did it.
I have a German license.
So you rented
it? Multiple times last week.
What were the purposes of that? Just over a...
Shopping trips, when okay. I had to go buy a bag and more clothes, and Dustin and I took the car to the Ferris wheel that we did as well. And... it's so fun to like scan a car like you scan a scooter and just the door opens.
It's insane.
And it just says, enjoy your ride. And it's not much more expensive than the scooter.
No.
You'll drive for like 20 minutes and pay like $4.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
One of the times I visited Estonia, when I visited Maria back in 2023, her car was getting worked on for the entire time I was there. And we took probably 20 of those cars to get to her work, to get back from her work. It was crazy. And it just seems so smart. But also, at the same time, seems like something that would only really be sustainable in a country like
Estonia.
Yeah, that's
not happening in the U.S.
That's not happening in the U.S. at all.
We can't have nice things.
Someone is going to figure out how to ruin it. But... yeah, I had a great week. Obviously, my girlfriend Maria lives, or at least she has an apartment. She doesn't live there that much anymore, but she has an apartment about 20 minutes south of Tallinn. And so I stayed there with her for the beginning of the week. And then my parents came to visit as part of a larger European trip. They came on Wednesday, and they got a Airbnb in the old town, right inside of the Vidu Gate near the McDonald's, and that was clutch. I had never experienced that, and I thought to myself, I probably wouldn't experience that because so many of these times I'm just gonna stay at Maria's place, and so I took them up on it, and I relocated halfway through the week, and. It was really nice at night, especially even Sunday night when we were out at a couple of the bars. I was thinking to myself, like, oh my gosh, we're on the same street as where our place is. And the one time we decided we were going to go play darts. I was like, oh, I need to go get my darts. And it was a 2-minute walk in each direction. Got my stuff and I was gone. And so it was a very sweet little place right in the heart of the city. And, yeah, we had some great times. We walked around, showed some of our friends the spots in Old Town. At this point, I've done a lot of that tour, I suppose, self-guided. But it's still fun every time. And this time, probably one of the things that stands out to me from this trip was we did archery up at the top, kind of near that Orthodox church.
Yeah.
And we had both of the Ravens with us. And... Raven Newsome saw it and he was like, we're stopping. We're going to go shoot bow and arrow. And all of the money that you spent goes towards the Estonian School of Archery. So that was pretty sweet. And it was cool. We had medieval little wrist guards and little gloves for pulling it back. And it was pretty sweet. It was cool to show a bunch of my friends around some of the spots that I've been. It was cool to show my parents a new city. And they did stuff that I haven't even done. Or Maria. That was pretty hilarious. They did a biking tour and a harbor cruise. And they were coming back every evening asking Maria, like, oh my gosh, like, have you heard of this? Or have you done that? Or have you seen this?
Well, the funny thing is, I was talking to my friends there. They never go to Old Town. If you're Estonian, you never go to Old Town.
You don't.
Like, I've done more stuff in Old Town than almost every Estonian.
Yep.
Which it kind of makes sense, because like, if you live somewhere, why would you go to the most touristy place?
Yeah. No, I agree. But it was a great week. Everything's so close. It's a really beautiful part of the country. The parks. There's a park even next door to the Song Festival Grounds, Kadriorg Park, which is essentially like the presidential park. Yeah. And I had never really seen that until Monday after the tournament. Maria took me around that park for the first time, which is in theory, I guess it's past a theory at this point, it's where the second course is going to be for the 2029 World Championships. And I have to say, I was much more impressed with that property than I expected to be. And I hope that Seppo and Ralph and whoever else is involved with the design do it justice, because there's actually a lot of elements in that park that I have not seen at the Song Festival Grounds. So I actually do think that it could be a pretty sweet course. And it's also way bigger, like way bigger. So there's an opportunity there to make a pretty special track.
Yeah, it's ginormous. I rode my scooter and bike through that park, and I was impressed as well.
Did you see the colorful building? Like, was it the art museum that had all the really pretty paint design on it? I'll show you. I have a picture of it. It was pretty great.
Isn't there a Japanese garden in there too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is.
You can see it on my vlog.
Wow, Joey is showing me some beautiful architecture. I do remember seeing that, actually.
Very nice.
Not this trip, but way back when I was roaming the streets with John Macbeth.
John Macbeth.
Oh, shout out John.
Shout out John. He just got married.
He got married?
Yeah, in Vegas.
Wow.
That's why Paul wasn't at Preserve, because it was the Macbeth wedding.
Wow. Man,
random shout out to John Macbeth.
John Macbeth's the GOAT.
He's a great guy. What were the things about this tournament that each of you liked, not like in your play, just like about, I mean, we all talk about, everybody's posts talk about how professionally this event is run and all the extra things that they do. So I wanted to ask both of you the things personally to each of you that...
Let's make a game out of it. Let's do a cycle. I'll say something, Simon says something, and Joey says something. Who wants to go first?
You can start.
I liked that the course was under 10,000 feet and the rounds went really quick.
Okay.
I like the player warm-up area where we can kind of like go inside the stadium and we have like a really nice clean area to warm up or just hang out, eat in, and enjoy privacy. Because most tournaments do not have that.
Yeah, that was the only spot on the property that was air conditioned, and it was no shoes. And I'll add this as my thing. My thing was the recovery tools, the warm up and recovery machines. There was foot massagers. There was two leg compressors, or whatever you call those things. There was multiple Theraguns. There was bands. There was balls. There was they had like KT tape. They had icy hot cream. Anything you could have thought of, they had in that space. And even this year, I feel like last year I don't remember this, but the first room that you see before you turn left, that whole area was reserved for players to sit, and they had all sorts of water and
I didn't even go there.
Yeah, I mean, I only just walked through it, but I saw a ton of players taking advantage of that. Back to you.
Back to me. I would say it's kind of the same as my first answer, but it just elaborates more on. I think I liked the course a lot, in all honesty. I liked that it... Okay, we're going to start getting into a conversation. It was easy, but it was also hard at the same time. It's only easy if you play good.
The only reason people think it's easy because they only see the top eight people play this course.
If you watch me play, it didn't look that easy.
Exactly. I mean, 90% of the field was struggling.
Yeah.
A lot on this track.
Right.
Like, if you're off by a couple feet, you will not have a good time.
Yeah, there's a stretch on the course. I think it's like 7, 8, 9. You could easily birdie all those. But you could go like 5, 5, 6 on that stretch of holes as well, just as easily.
I mean, yeah. You could go... I took a 6 the final round on 7. At least the third final round for me on 7. After bullseyeing 7 both mm-hmm. days prior for birdie. And I took a 6 where I mean, I felt like I threw one bad shot, and it was my drive, which hit, thanks to both of you, I didn't miss the Mando, but it hit and sat, then I pitched up, and I threw my forehand like an inch too long on that, my third shot to get me mm-hmm. a par, and it was out of bounds by an inch on the back of the island, a shot that I was very happy with, considering the run-up. And from there, I pinned it with my next shot, double bogey.
Yeah. For me, it's interesting because you want to start out hot, and you definitely, if you're wanting to be in contention, then yes, you need birdies. But even if you bogey or have a few rough holes, you need to lock back in and continue the birdie train.
Oh yeah.
And like, it was interesting because my tournament, not that great. Like, I had 3 rounds that were mediocre to bad, but enough to kind of keep me in it. And I had a pretty good round at 12 under. And that 12 under like jumped me way up there. And that just shows, it's like, you want to shred the whole time, but if you put in one exceptional round, you can make some moves still. There was actually a ton of scoring separation on that course. If you mm-hmm. look from first place to last cash, I think it was some like crazy number. It was like 30 something strokes. And I just think it's interesting. I think it's interesting golf to watch. Like, I enjoy watching players get birdies. I enjoy seeing like players have to birdie out if they want to win.
And I think every hole was bogeyable.
There's a clutch factor, and it's so funny because it's kind of paradoxical, where an easy course can actually be harder.
It's a different kind of challenge. It's a different kind of, that the pressure it's a different score. Kind,
right. Because 16, 17, and 18, like 16's a touchy little shot. 17's a touchy little shot. And 18 is like, you gotta put a good angle on it. You gotta put it wide enough. You gotta ride the wind. And in some instances, it's kind of hard to put it in the circle. If the wind's blowing, I think there's a lot of great challenge to that course. And I'm not saying every course needs to be like this, but I would not mind seeing more courses adopt a style like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also explains a lot of the big rated rounds. I think we have a huge misconception in this sport about how ratings actually work. And it's literally based, the amount of times I read comments or they're like, oh, the European courses rate easier, or that's not how it works. It's literally just about the players in the field and the scores mm-hmm. that they get. That has nothing to do, or at least extremely little to do, with the course. It really doesn't. And so going into this week, if you were an educated disc golf fan, you would have assumed already, or at least predicted, that there were going to be high-rated rounds because you have all the best players in the world. That's condition number one to get 1,100-rated rounds. Condition number two is the most important, which is a scoreable course with OB on every hole.
Score separation.
Score separation. And so we had three 1100 rated rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people, you know, you compare it to Fountain Hills. Well, there you go. A scoreable course with OB potential on almost every hole out there. It's a little less than a European Disc Golf Festival, but you can throw it into the water on almost every single hole at Fountain Hills. But yeah. You can also shoot 16 down. And that's where you really get those high-rated rounds because you have high-rated players shooting even or over par on the same day that another high-rated player shoots a 15-under, a 16-under.
Got to be on your mark. You got to execute if you want to play well. And that's always the case, but that's not really. Like, I think a good example is a course like Shelton Springs. You have to be somewhat on your mark. You can kind of spray it around the fairway as long as you're getting kind of up the fairway and maybe getting down the fairway on your second shot. Like you can scrounge together a par, maybe like a few birdies and shoot like 4-under. And that's going to be like a pretty good round. But like if you go out to Shelton Springs on the same day as you go out to the Lauvallac and you can play terrible on Shelton Springs and play a better round than you would on, say, the Tallinn course.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can not objectively be throwing bad on Shelton Springs and play a, quote, good round. Like, I made lead card at Shelton Springs, and I felt like I played bad.
Yeah.
If you want to make lead card at Tallinn, you have to absolutely shred.
Yeah, you do. You do. You have to because, I mean, I think it's
a that make sense what I just said?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think it also just alludes to the fact that a course like Shelton Springs, whether we like it or not, is going to have more luck involved. Like, it just will. It's just wooded courses that, like, if you miss the perfect line, you're coin flipping whether or not you sneak through or if you don't. And on this course, I feel like hole two, I suppose, after watching Gavin Babcock's triple bogey on 18, the final round or the third round, hole one's green potentially. But I felt like hole two was one of the only like really like luck based holes. And boy, did it bite me in the butt through the first two rounds. I bet it was worse for me than for you.
Oh, yeah.
For the first two rounds.
Yeah, I heard your story. Oh, my God.
I really don't feel like I threw. And if I feel like I threw bad, I will like happily admit it. I don't feel like I threw a bad shot through the first two rounds, and I shot 6 over on that hole. I took a 7 the first round, and I took a 5 this second round. And hole 5, or on the second round, I missed my putt low by, I mean, if it had been a centimeter lower or a centimeter higher, even a centimeter lower, it would have been a par. And if it had been a centimeter higher, it would have been a birdie. And instead, it was a double. Just gone. And so, but I do feel like that hole was one of the few that had.
Yeah. I think it was fine in the day one and two's position.
Day three was my best score. I took a par. I was so happy to be all the way down at the bottom of the hill, barely inbounds, and have a simple jump putt up to the top. But, I mean, I think they changed some good stuff about the course. I like the changes that they made. My biggest issue with the course last year was 12, 13, 14 being like three almost 500-foot carry heisers. Shots. Yeah, heisers. And I think they did a great job on those holes. I think hole 12, it is a softer par 4, but if you want to be in the spot to attack, you have to swing that OB. Like you want to be like 5 feet safe.
They created a good little choke point there.
And there's multiple ways to attack the second shot. I mean, you can go up the middle. They didn't put a mando on those trees to allow you to throw that hyzer
around.
And
you can go out of bounds taking the hyzer.
Yeah, you can.
I would know.
Oh, you would?
You did it?
I yanked it.
Oh.
That's one of the only holes I birdied every round.
I was...
Well, I have a solution to all our course design problems, by the way.
Okay.
Smaller baskets. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to die on this hill, probably. But the more I think about it, the more I... Like, every year. I mean, this small basket has been a topic for years in disc golf, of course.
I felt like the baskets we just putted on were smaller.
I agree. Yeah. Those Prodigy baskets probably give me the least confidence out of any basket, but I think majors and elite series events should have their own basket, and it should be smaller, significantly smaller. And every single course design flaw we have will be fixed. Every scoring issue we have will be fixed. Putting will no longer be a joke.
I tend to mostly agree.
We will only play fair courses. Nothing comes down to trees in the middle of the fairway. Gotta have OB everywhere. Like, you just gotta throw freaking good shots.
You gotta put it close. I mean, the premium on upshot accuracy or tee shot accuracy on par threes becomes serious. I think that once you got past hole 11, I guess 11 wasn't 11. Seemed like kind of like the last of those nasty holes, because it felt like once you got past 11, but 11 in the day one and two positions, I mean, I bullseyed it both days. I mean, that took really good tee shot, but that long position is really tough birdie.
It is really tough.
And that tee shot, you can throw lots of different ways, but it felt like once you got past that, it was like pedal to the metal. I mean, you could birdie out on that course pretty easily.
I almost did.
I was a couple putts away from birdieing out my second round. And it was a treat, honestly. The venue is really special. I will say, I think there's a couple spots where I think they could tuck some baskets. I think hole 6, they could probably tuck that basket a little bit further back and maybe take one or two trees out to actually make like a clean
hole 4.
They can't take a tree out.
Oh, they can't touch trees.
They told me they can't touch a leaf.
Ooh. So it's up to us then to hit it hard enough.
Correct.
Okay, but I think you could tuck a basket back.
Hole 4 could be tucked back a little bit further and only have one pin location.
Yeah. Or make it a par 3 and make it like a hard tee shot. Yeah.
Did you know where that... they had that like whatever it was that was covered up by like a Cramo little like cover on hole 4. It was like a power box that had been covered up, like where a good second shot or a good tee shot would land. That's what me and Yona Hainan in round 1 were discussing. Like, that would be a great par 3 because I like that tee shot through the gap.
Yeah,
the second shot's kind of like mostly you're just going up and over and crashing.
Yeah, it was a flawed hole.
That was the only hole I birdied every... Oh no. 18 and 16. I birdied all three of my rounds. For me, now I have an interesting thing to say here about 18. I think for someone like me, that hole is easier than for someone like you guys. Because for me, that hole is like one of the easiest holes that I play because I can't go long. I don't have the distance. And so I don't have to throw this big spiking, like way high, way wide. Like all I had to do was just take my dimension and throw it like almost on like kind of a low line, like towards the kind of right side of the grandstand. And I mean, I was bullseye's edge every round. And I don't know, maybe it was just how that hole lined up for me. And it was the same with hole 16. I mean, for me, hole 16 is like a hole that I grew up playing, like a low ceiling. I just threw a resistor every round to just
Did you birdie every round?
Yeah, every round.
I did too.
Yeah.
Hole 16?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
that's one of Eagle's nightmare holes.
I got 3 out of 4.
Oh, you nailed the forehand.
I got forehand every time.
Oh.
Do you want to hear of my most horrendous, scary stat?
Oh, no.
Hole 8 and 17. If you combine them, I was 6 over on.
I mean, I'm not surprised. But.
And I didn't feel like I threw them that bad. I was just like, I always got the worst kick you possibly could or went out the back. And you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I like the shots that we're throwing, but I hate the flukiness. The one way I'm going to give credit to Austin Hannum, because I was talking to him about this on the boat. If you want to get rid of the fluke factor on those holes, you make them both island shots and you put a drop zone, because if somebody, you either pure the shot, go to the drop zone, because there's so many times where you throw a shot and you kick and goes left or goes right or luckily stay in bounds. At the very least, if you don't put it in the island, then you get in a bogey. It's either a bogey or a birdie. I think
how
that
far
would be,
should the drop zone be? Like a little 100-foot pitch or like a jump putt?
I'd say like 65, 70 feet.
So
like
a potential for a save.
A potential save.
Is that fair for like a shank to be given a par save?
Or every tree is a Mando.
Every tree's a Mando.
And you just go from...
There's like 10 drop zones?
There's 10 drop zones. Wherever you go out is where you drop.
Right there. I mean,
then you get the exact punishment you deserve.
I pured that hole 8 the first two rounds. I was 30 feet and then just inside the bullseye. And there was no luck involved. And then the third round, I barely missed it inside and hit one of the last trees down to the left and had a favorable kick and took my par. But I felt like on that last round, I could have totally gotten screwed and death kicked because the first two rounds, there's no luck involved. I threw the exact line that the hole was intending. I mean, once you miss your gap a little, I mean, the degree of punishment can be...
They're not very nice with the OB lines too. It's like, it's like a good meter inside the concrete. Like there's a lot of grass.
At least
still
they
safe.
Put that wall down inside the circle to stop discs from going out of bounds. But we have to touch on the biggest thing that happened on hole 8.
Rock and roll.
Rock and roll. And it was such a nice step up from round 1.
Yeah, I went on that hole. I went double bogey, ace, birdie.
Wow.
So still shot under par on that hole, which was nice.
You beat me by 5 strokes on that one hole.
There you go.
So can you walk us through?
That means you beat me on the rest of the course.
Yeah.
The ace was awesome. I mean, timing was weird. I was a bit in a bad mood because I just shot like 3 over on the last 3 holes leading up to it. So I think we can all agree that ace running that hole is not the play.
That was in your mind?
I mean, I didn't care to like lay up. I don't think I was thinking, oh, let's ace this. I was just trying to hit the gap.
Was it a good shot? Because you've famously said any shot that goes in that's an ace is not a good shot.
I think on the way it flew.
There's a few exceptions, but it's rare that an ace is actually a good shot. And in this case, I think it probably would have fallen
and hit the wall. So it would have been
safe for sure.
Yeah, I think this one would have been safe. So it was
and
a good,
good
shot.
And it's good because you hit the gap. Like just getting down into that airspace clean the right way makes it inherently a good shot.
Yeah, but as pros, we should be good enough to land at 20 feet short versus pin like chain high passing the basket. Like those are two big differences in shots. So,
but I'd also argue to say it's like sometimes it's good to play it past the basket,
especially on a gap like that. I mean, if you're like, just if you're more confident,
throw through it, not to it.
More power.
Well, regardless. It definitely lifted spirits.
The drought is over.
Drought is over. First major ace. Do you guys have a major ace?
I do not have
an
elite series ace. I don't have an A tier ace. I barely have any ace.
Well, I once heard from a very reliable source that you don't have a real ace until you have a world ace.
So who's this case, real? Is this Paul McBeth?
I think it's Germ.
Oh.
I think we all don't have a real ace at this point, but at least I have the major ace. I think that's a good first step. And
then you got,
I mean,
thunder
I think
stolen.
From my reaction in the video, you can see that I just was in like just disbelief. I didn't even celebrate. I was just looking like, how did that just happen? Like out of all the holes, this is the one after 8 years. It was crazy. But nice, different feeling. I didn't remember what it felt like to not have to putt.
Did you run it all the way down or did you let everyone play?
No, I actually let someone else throw at the basket where my disc was in. I asked if I should clear it and he said no.
How has your journey been up to this point of getting an ace? Has it just been like spit outs or just like nothing coming close?
No, I've had many close calls. I had a dead center spit out Idlewild last year on hole 17.
Mm-hmm.
Also a hex. Which was actually like a perfect shot. I was playing like crab and totally ran it for the ace. So I threw it exactly like I wanted to, and it was literally perfect height, dead center, and spit right back out. So I've been saying it all year. I think I even said it on the vlog or in the podcast at some point that one of my main goals this year is to get a tournament ace because it's been so long. I just felt like it's such a drought. So it's off the list now, which is nice. And
must be nice.
It was nice. The weirdest thing was that from what I remember and how a tournament ace feels, like it like spikes your adrenaline and like it, your heart starts like pumping and you feel like super excited. And then it makes the next shot like almost impossible to throw because you're so hyped.
The ace slump.
And I didn't feel that at all. So I was like almost on the next tee, hole nine, which is basically a 400-foot hyzer. I was like almost confused. Like, why am I not feeling anything? I felt so normal. And I just was like, okay, lining up my shot. Obviously, I was first in the box. And threw probably the worst shot that hole saw.
You went OB left, right?
I went OB left by like 20 feet. Like, it was not close. And I mean, I threw the freaking aerobie better on that hole, which, oh my God, I couldn't believe it. So I guess maybe the ace did have an effect after all. At least I hope it did, because that then it shot wasn't needed even, an excuse.
It wasn't even the biggest moment of that day. Isaac Robinson had to freaking go in and steal your thunder and ace 18 to shoot 1100 rated. And yeah. This is the only praise I'll give the Prodigy Basket. Shout out to the Prodigy Basket for catching that.
That's a catch right there.
I mean, your ace at least came in pretty soft. His ace slammed into that basket.
I would say no other basket would have caught that.
I think you might be right.
Maybe a Mach X. I don't know.
Maybe a Mach X. Probably a
Mach X, yeah.
I think it was very impressive catch. And I mean, he was playing out of his mind for the first two rounds of the tournament.
15 under.
The same day, Calvin shot 15 under. And then Macbeth went on the next day to shoot 16 under. And I got to say, I mean, of course, I feel like, you know, that course sets up well for somebody like Paul Macbeth. Lots of OB. Accuracy is important. But it's cool to see him playing well again. He's been in contention a couple times this year. And I mean, he has not won an Elite Series event since 2023 PCS Open.
Yeah.
So it was cool to see him in contention. And man, a course like this really does produce some excitement down the end. And we got to see, I mean, it's been a while. I think maybe the last time was maybe the Burrage Lizotte playoff at Des Moines, maybe Proctor winning MVP Open last year. But I think this topped that as far as excitement at the end. Were either of you, where were you guys? Did you guys stick around to watch the end, or were you back in your respective places?
I had a really disappointing end, actually, the way I lived that moment.
Okay.
I was back at the hotel, just having a beer and debating my existence on how poorly I played that week. even though I just had 10 birdies in a row to finish my round, the final round. But I was just kind of like just, you know, decompressing a bit and watching the coverage and saw Calvin's final shot on 18. First of all, the putt he missed on 17, I was like, oh no, here we go again. Calvin, the anti-clutch factor hitting again. And then his tee shot on 18, like,
not great.
That is a bad shot.
Yeah.
Like, it's not great is already saying too much. Like, it was just bad.
And he said on camera after that he hadn't thrown that hole well at any point in the week, even in practice.
I don't understand how you don't throw that hole well. It's like it's the easiest hole on the course, in my opinion. Like, the tower on the right gives you even like an aiming point.
I aimed at the tower every time and I just threw it bad.
I mean, I agree with you. I birdied it every round.
I agree.
Like, if I don't hit the circle, I feel like I just threw the worst shot of my round, basically.
I agree.
But anyway, the feed obviously is like 15, 20 seconds behind real life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching, Calvin was about to line up his putt, and I suddenly hear the loudest roar coming from the stadium. And I was like, wait, there's no way the freaking crowd just spoiled this putt for me this moment. I was like so hyped for Calvin to line up this putt, and I knew he was going to make it before he was going to make it, because the crowd was
staying
like
too close,
300 feet away.
You got to stay somewhere else next year.
So I was watching, hear the roar, and I'm like, wait, there's no way he freaking makes this. I was like ready mentally. I was ready for a playoff. And then I was ready for him to make it. And he freaking like hearted it. Perfect height, perfect angle. Similar to Adam's putt back in Waco. It reminded me of that a bit. Obviously, 10 times bigger stage.
And a little further.
A little further, yeah.
And but the similar celebration.
Heart, similar heart of the basket.
Yeah.
And just zero doubts. That was so sick.
And he was so, like, I mean, I think it's interesting for a guy like Calvin. You know, I don't know if any of you guys listen to going to golf. There was a pretty head-turning press conference that was given by Scottie Scheffler before the Open, where he talked about winning and how he works all this time and all these hours and he celebrates for about 20 seconds, you know, and then he goes on. And I was kind of, I mean, that one definitely like hit me and I was listening to it and I related to a bunch of it. I think it was pretty controversial. I think it still is. He went on to win the Open by 5 or 4 shots. And I think that what he's saying is very true for the guys that dominate with winning, like Gannon or Paul, guys who win a lot. For someone like Calvin, I don't think it applies. For somebody who has been inside the top 5 in the world for the last 6 or 7, maybe 7 years, he has not a ton of wins. And I think you can see it when he does win, how emotional it makes him and how much relief it makes. And I mean, that celebration was, I mean, that's the most you're going to see out of Calvin right there, those 15 seconds following that. And we were talking about it at his victory dinner after, afterwards. And he kind of agreed. He was just like, I think for me, every win feels amazing because I'm not winning every week, even though I mentally feel like I could be winning every week based on the positions I put myself in. And, what a moment. Were you at the course or were you back?
I was at NOP.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Did you know? Were you watching?
I was watching. Yeah, it was hype. Like, Calvin's never going to be able to say he hasn't won a major.
Yep. And the trophy was pretty sweet. A great trophy to take home. And yeah, I mean, back to the rating, he apparently, from what I understand, he set the record, which I suppose breaks either your European Open or Kona Piste record for event average for a major, 1080. That's what he averaged for the 4 rounds. And
1080.
His worst round being 9 under.
That was my best round.
That was the opening round for Calvin.
Holy cannoli.
9 under. That's right. And I talked to him right after that first round and he was pissed. He was very disappointed because he said he was putting for birdie on 17 of the 18 holes. So to shoot 9 under, I mean, all 3 of us know how that feels to throw and give yourself all those opportunities and then not cash in on the putts. And, you know, he did just enough. And, I mean, it was a hilarious post-tournament interview. He said after he missed that putt on 17, he didn't say the nicest things to himself. But that whole walk down 18, he was talking to himself the entire way down, talking himself into making it. And, you know, that shows to me like someone who I don't think is known for his self-talk on the rounds, on the course, understanding like what needs to be done in that moment to get yourself into making a putt like that. And just a really epic win.
What a routine on that putt too.
I mean, he did it for most of the putts for most of the tournaments.
Just like, how do you start that? And then just like, oh yeah, that works. Let's do that.
Yeah. And I mean, there's been some memes already now.
Yeah. I saw that.
I think it's pretty great.
Pretty good.
And, on the FPO side, another big moment for our teammate.
Wild.
Silva Saarinen comes from behind. I won't sugarcoat it. Kind of a collapse from Kristen, which unfortunately
you hate
has
to see it.
Started to become a bit of a theme this year. And she, from what it looked like, just sort of lost control of her body a little bit on the putts. especially the putts she felt like she should make. And I mean, the credit still goes to Silva for applying the pressure. I mean, if Kristen had a 6 or a 7 stroke lead going into the back nine, who knows if that same pressure exists. But I mean, this is the woman who essentially said no to everything that whole week. She didn't do the Superstar Challenge, which was actually won by her team. Team Estonia took down the Superstar Challenge in a pretty dramatic fashion. She didn't play basically any practice rounds, and, you know, showed up with essentially, I mean, what she still has is a fractured toe and pretty mediocre first round. She was on like 7th or 8th card out on the second round, and her gallery was twice the size of the FPO lead card, and she shot her way back onto the lead card and then into the lead going into the final round. And I mean, Silva had to, she birdied 7 out of the last 9 holes.
Yeah, where were we watching the final round? Were you part of that?
No, I was cooking breakfast, watching the scores in Old Town, thinking to myself that if Silva birdied one more hole or got one more stroke, I was going to have to like giddy up over there. And then I forgot that I was supposed to be doing that because I was eating. And then I looked and they were tied and they were on 14. And so I hopped in a Bolt and got over there just in time to witness the shots on 18 and the putt. And
we were watching at breakfast with like a group of 5 or 6 disc golfers. And I think at that point, Kristen had like a 4 or 5 stroke lead with like 9 holes to go or something along those lines. Yep. And everyone was saying like, oh yeah, it looks like it's going to be a victory lap for Kristen on the back nine. And like more comments like that. And I was just like, guys, have you been watching what's been happening on tour this year with Kristen? Like, there's no way this is going to be a victory lap for Kristen. Like, I don't know. I felt like something was going to happen. I didn't want to see it go down like that, obviously. But it's almost unexplainable. I remember watching when it happened that the putts on 17, I was completely speechless.
She cracked under the home crowd pressure, which, I mean, it's to be noted, even on MPO, our teammate Mauri Vilman, who finished tied for 9th. I mean, I went out and filmed him.
I played with him final round.
There was big galleries for these Estonian players.
Oh my gosh.
These people really showed up to support their country people. No more so than Kristen. And I think that, I mean, I don't think any of us, you guys have some clue. I mean, I have no idea what that kind of pressure feels like when you have everyone there hoping.
Yeah, you can't move your body.
Yeah,
you can't move your body right.
I was speechless. It was so like, sad.
I don't know what happened, but I know exactly what she feels like.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way I can put it. And I don't want to even really speculate on what might be going through her head, but a broken toe can't help.
No, but that was not a broken toe.
Right.
There at the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, the fact that she played as well as she did with that and was right there, it just shows you that, you know, she's a very, very, very talented player. And I do believe that she is the best player in FPO when everything is right, which this year it obviously isn't. And that kind of gives even more credit to her skills because mm-hmm. she's having what everyone would consider an off year. And she's like in contention to win almost every tournament, which just kind of shows you like if she's 100% mentally and physically, the dominance would be insane. But I think you really experienced this in 2019, which was kind of like in 2018, you finally won the first big one and it just kind of like opened the floodgates. You won GBO, you won Beaver mm-hmm. State Fling, you played Kona Piste in record fashion. And I remember kind of in the first year that we became friends, there was a lot of this kind of like pressure, or you just like this self-created pressure of like, I don't know. I think in those first
years
self, of
it dominance, it is self-created.
It feels so easy. And then you say, oh, I got to go do it again.
It's just tough because there's a certain time where no one really expects anything out of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there starts becoming expectations. Mm-hmm. And managing those expectations and not really giving thought to them is key. I don't know. It's a whole psychological rabbit hole that I still don't even understand.
Yeah.
Because it's like disc golf. Once you put yourself in that state of mind and you expect high performance out of yourself, and if you don't get that high performance, disc golf's not fun. Like, I'll flat out say it. Like, what is joyful and your favorite thing to do can become the complete opposite. And I don't know if Kristen's going through that right now. I'm sure there's probably certain levels of it where she probably doesn't want to play disc golf. There's other things that are more fun to do. But it's tough because it is your job. And then, like, you come back around once you take a little time away from disc golf, whether it's like, you know, it can be as much as like 2 or 3 days to just reframe your perspective, that it's pretty awesome. But like, gosh, I don't know.
I think as sad and terrible it was last week, I think it might be good for Kristen what happened, in a sense that maybe she hit rock bottom.
There's a certain element to that as well.
I mean, that has to be.
And once you're at rock bottom, there's only one way you can go.
I mean, if you could draw up the rock bottom situation for Kristen, it would be that right there.
Yeah, and I think
having
that would
a title in your home country in the palm of your hand,
as heartbreaking and miserable as it is, it can only really help.
It can only go up.
I can go back to many of my worst experiences on the disc golf course, and like, some of my best experiences were not far after.
I mean, Portland Open to Beaver State.
Yeah, 1 week.
Portland Open was like brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And then Beaver State was your first win.
Yeah.
And that was a really...
I mean, last year, I played these European events so unbelievably bad, and I just felt so awful about myself and my life. And then I went to have my best finish of the year at Worlds at a podium, which was like really, I still feel really good about. So it's like, you never know. It's like you need like a harsh kick in the pants sometimes. And that's the only thing that can set you on a different track. So we're
picking Kristen for Worlds.
Exactly. I think Kristen is my pick for Worlds.
Yeah, I think it does hinge on her foot health. But mentally, yeah, I mean, she obviously showed that like the foot wasn't in serious enough pain to allow her to play well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what an unbelievable week at an unbelievable property in an unbelievable city. And we're going to be back.
We got to give props to Silva. There's a good second here.
Yeah, props to Silva.
That's a good episode name.
Unbelievable week.
Just unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, she made some huge putts down the stretch.
She was there to take advantage.
Yeah, and she
made some sick putts.
She created the pressure.
She was there when she had to be there, and
yeah, shout out Silva. She took advantage,
and we get to play with her on Sunday afternoon for her second practice round of the year, and I think it's just been cool. We filmed her in the bag as she's coming out of her shell. I mean, this woman came right off the course and went straight into one interview, two interviews, three interviews, four interviews, five interviews, and 200 autographs. And it was unbelievable the composure and maturity and smile that she handled it all with. Because I think a lot of people don't quite realize how like kind of intense it gets when you win. I mean, there's this moment of amazing joy and jubilation. And then you're just whisked around to every corner of the venue to talk to this person and then talk to the Estonian broadcast and then talk to the newspaper and then talk to MDG and then go back up to the little conference table and... And then you go down to a table where there's like 150 people waiting for a little conversation, a little signature, maybe a photo, and you're finished. You know, you don't want to talk to anyone. You want to go off into the woods and pick blueberries with your sister. I mean, that's her favorite activity.
Mustica.
And yeah, it was just impressive. I was there kind of at her side to just make sure she had somebody to kind of get her from place to place without getting mobbed the whole time. And I was really impressed with how she handled it all. Obviously, she was elated too. That helps when you win. that it makes it easier to do all those things. But it's been a really impressive season for her. And after Music City Open, I was worried about what kind of year this was going to be. But I think that goes to your point. Music City Open was rock bottom for Silva.
No, that wasn't rock bottom.
But it was horrible.
It sucked.
It sucked. And but she responded.
Rock bottom looks different.
She responded in a way that I was not expecting and went on to play some really solid tournaments and take down two Elite Series wins and now a major. And, you know, she's got Worlds now in her home country, and I'm excited to see how she attacks these two courses. I think the Monster certainly lines up quite well for her game, and I don't feel like the Beast is, you know, too far out of her range. I think she also, I have been giving her not enough credit on how far she can throw. I mean, she is more than competent in the FPO distance class.
Totally.
So we had a great time, and we're here in Finland now, and I think we're going to save most of that chat for our next week's episode.
Are we going to do pre-Worlds episode, or are we going to do sometime during Worlds episode?
I'm fine to do a pre-Worlds. It's up to you guys.
Pre-Worlds episode for Worlds.
Yeah, I mean,
so
I think
Tuesday night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Crush Pepper XL.
Oh, we just crossed the line. Although we were rolling for 2 minutes before. So it's a little misleading. Okay. What are we naming this episode?
Unbelievable.
Perfect.
Unbelievable. All right. Well, sign us out, Birdman.
Well, thank you guys for listening to the podcast that Joey, Simon, and myself host. We appreciate every single one of you, and we hope that you all have a great day and a great round. Keep on dreaming.
But should we turn on the sauna?
Yes, we should.
All right, let's do it.